Move over fat, salt, and eggs. The food world has a new villain.
Is sugar toxic?
I believe it is.
Bitter truth or sweet hysteria? I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
In the old days, you spent a lot of time at the patient's bedside, and now the common saying is that you spend more time with the computer.
You know, people will want to wait in my waiting room for me because it's me.
He was like, forget it, because I can't pay it out of pocket.
Trees can't move as fast as climate changes.
200 degrees is a lot more tolerable
than
one would
think. Am I an alcoholic?
You know, when you think about it, a connected refrigerator isn't actually a horrible idea.
He's the first who's saying the emperor has no clothes.
On today's show, the vaccine wars. What's behind parents' attitudes toward vaccination? Big money buys naming rights for med schools. Why some bristle at this concept? And designing websites that work for people with disabilities. But first up, health researchers are waging an attack against sugar. This is the latest in a long line of foods that are believed to be bad for us, but researchers are saying that we eat so much sugar that it dwarfs the risks posed by previously vilified foods. In this light, the government has recently proposed new nutrition policies that include a fresh take on sugar. Reporter Audrey Quinn takes a look at our changing perception of the sweet stuff.
Lisa Young's a nutritionist and a professor at New York University, and today she's in a Manhattan grocery store, following up on the whereabouts of a certain suspect, added sugar.
I'm curious about this teriyaki sauce.
She grabs a bottle off the shelf.
10 grams of sugar. That's a lot of sugar. That teriyaki was good. I didn't realize it had so much. You know, you don't even realize.
She finds her target again in the light option salad dressing. 7 grams of sugar.
Yeah, so I mean, pasta sauce also, you'd be surprised.
9 grams of sugar. Young's worried about what all this stealthy sugar is doing to our bodies, and her concern comes from research like Kimber Stanhope's.
I'm Dr. Kimber Stanhope, and I'm a research scientist at the University of California, Davis.
Stanhope says sugar, it travels in your small intestine right to your liver.
That gives the liver first rights to all the sugar we eat.
The sugar we eat, both basic table sugar and high fructose corn syrup, one of the main parts of it is something called fructose. When we have too much sugar, we overload our liver with fructose, and that makes it turn some of that fructose into fat.
And there's two problems with turning that into fat.
One, that means the liver sends more fat into the blood, which increases your risk for cardiovascular disease, heart and blood problems. And two, the fat that stays in the liver causes the liver to have problems with insulin, which increases your risk for diabetes. This overloaded fatty liver, it might sound familiar. It's what happens when you have too much alcohol, something a lot of us try to limit because we know it's bad for our livers. But here's sugar doing something very similar, and I bet your liver's the last thing on your mind when you reach for that second donut.
Why should this concern me? I'm someone who takes decent care of my body. I don't have a family history of diabetes.
So even in a healthy person who might not even gain weight, it's possible that this damage is accumulating over time.
But scientists warning us about sugar have a bit of a PR problem. Nutrition history. Sugar's not the first food to get this villain treatment. We spent the second half of the last century being warned against fat, eggs, and salt. And scientists have come back around on all three of those. Foods we've misidentified as bad for us could fill a whole book. British people in the 1600s thought tomatoes could kill you. The Pythagoreans of ancient Greece wouldn't even touch beans. What if sugar is just the latest example of misdirected concerns?
I think that is a completely fair question, and I don't blame you a bit for asking.
Stanhope says yes, we have gotten a lot of conflicting messages about food in the past few decades. But the evidence against sugar has been growing, and she trusts it's going to keep growing.
It is going to only become more definitively proven that sugar is bad.
Nicole Levine is a neuroscientist at Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York. About 15 years ago, she noticed a lot of people talking about how they felt addicted to sugar.
There really wasn't any scientific evidence. There wasn't really any carefully controlled or conducted studies on this.
So she joined a team that was starting a study, in rats to begin with.
We started off looking for, you know, just simple classic signs of addiction. Would these rats show signs of withdrawal, or would they show signs of binging or tolerance if we just simply let them have access to sugar solutions?
And that's what she found. And then she started looking at the brains of rats showing signs of sugar addiction.
So we started looking at different neurotransmitters like the opioids and dopamine. And we noted that there were changes in gene expression, changes in the release of those neurotransmitters that were similar to what you'd see if an animal was on a low dose of a drug of abuse like nicotine or even alcohol or morphine.
These sugar-hooked rats' brains looked like drug addicts' brains. In the past few years, she's been working with human subjects and finding similar things. People who show addiction-like behaviors towards sugar, they also show drug addiction-like changes in their brain. To be clear, we're mainly talking here about foods with added sugar, not healthy foods with natural sugar like apples or yogurt. And this doesn't happen to everyone, but when it does, it seems to have something to do with dopamine, the brain chemical that makes us feel good. When you're eating something for the first time, you usually get a little boost of dopamine. And then that goes away after you've eaten it a few more times.
But we're discovering when someone's addicted to a food, the dopamine release in response to candy corn, let's say, happens every single time you have a candy corn. It's no longer like a food, and it's more like what you'd see with a drug.
So maybe we aren't just weak-willed when it comes to sugar. There could be something going on biologically that compels some of us to keep eating it. The government's nutrition policies have so far been pretty hands-off when it comes to sugar. But their new draft for dietary guidelines recommends adults get less than 10% of their calories from added sugar. Right now, the average American gets 16%. And the Food and Drug Administration has proposed changes to their nutrition labels.
Because right now, the labels are totally unclear.
That's Lisa Young again, the nutritionist and NYU researcher. Right now, food labels just have one line for sugar, regardless of where it comes from. So if you're choosing foods based on sugar content, that cup of plain yogurt, which has a good amount of naturally occurring sugar from lactose, it looks just as healthy as that can of soda, which is all added sugar and no nutritional value.
There's been a big push to have a separate section for added sugar.
The FDA is proposing to give added sugar its own line on nutrition labels. They put the total cost for this relabeling at over $2 billion. But they expect that the effect of the new labels, a better awareness of added sugar, will lead to $20 to $30 billion in healthcare savings over the next two decades. For The Pulse, I'm Audrey Quinn.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. From sugar on to another health topic everybody is talking about right now, vaccines. It's not a new issue, of course. The anti-vaccine movement started getting big in the late 90s, but the recent measles outbreak that originated at Disneyland in California has really brought things to a boiling point. But will anything change? Joining us now is Allison Buttenheim. She is an assistant professor in the School of Nursing at the University of Pennsylvania, and she studies vaccine attitudes. Allison, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
What have you learned about parental thoughts and perceptions of vaccines and vaccine safety?
I'd say, you know, we hear a lot in the media right now with the outbreak that it's this autism fear that parents have, particularly with the MMR vaccine. But our research suggests there's a really broad range of fears that parents can articulate. Sometimes they say, it's just so many shots that you're putting into my teeny little baby, and I'd rather just wait on some of those or space them out. We also hear concerns that are particularly worrisome, I think, that, you know, we don't need these shots. These diseases aren't very common. They're not very dangerous. Or, you know, my kid has such a healthy diet or such a healthy lifestyle that they'll be protected naturally. So there's, besides the autism fear, there are lots of other concerns parents have.
What did you learn? Is there any kind of correlation with the education level of the parents, perhaps even income? I'm thinking about access to healthcare.
Sure. I mean, the access and the socioeconomic status, I think, are separate issues. So let me start with have access. We have an amazing public-private partnership in the U.S., Vaccines for Children, the VFC program. And basically, if you want to get your kid vaccinated, even if you're uninsured or underinsured, if your kid is Medicaid eligible, VFC will pay for those vaccines. So while we do see slightly lower rates of vaccine coverage for lower-income kids, that's not the bulk of the gap. In terms of vaccine hesitancy or outright refusal, that very much is associated with higher-income parents, wealthier parents, and of course, they tend to sort of cluster both in space and sort of socially. So that's where we worry epidemiologically that the parents who aren't vaccinating live together, go to school together, are in communities together.
Let's talk a little bit about the numbers. What do we know about how many kids in the U.S. are not vaccinated?
We extrapolated from some data from the CDC. They run the National Immunization Survey, and they have a figure for sort of the toddler age range of how many kids have no vaccines at all. And if we sort of expand that to all kids under age 10, we think there are about 280,000 kids who have received no vaccines at all. Other data that the CDC collects on how many kids have an exemption at the moment when they enter kindergarten from whatever vaccines the state mandates for that school entry time. And that's been around 2%, between 1.5% and 2% of kids across all states, and states have different laws about these exemptions. But if you sort of expand that to look at maybe kindergarten to fourth grade right now, we think there are about 400,000 kids in the U.S. who have an exemption from one or more state-mandated vaccines. That doesn't mean they haven't received that vaccine necessarily, but their parent has applied for an exemption.
So that's a very small number,
yep.
Right? So speaking of people's fears about things, are perhaps the fears that this will really cause some kind of outbreak overblown?
Well, if everyone were protected, if our herd immunity or our community immunity from measles were intact, we would not have seen 600 cases last year in the U.S., and we wouldn't see 100 cases or more from this Disneyland outbreak. It doesn't sound like a lot to say 280,000 or 400,000 kids across the whole U.S. might be missing some of these shots. But again, when it's a clustered behavior and there's a higher chance that a kid with measles, and we have to remember measles is very highly infectious, there's just more of a chance in these clustered communities that a sick kid will bump into a kid who hasn't been vaccinated and is susceptible to the disease.
Everybody's talking about vaccines right now, and some people say this outbreak might have one positive effect, and that is that perhaps it will show people that vaccines are important. What do you think? Will this have a lasting impact?
I would like to say yes, but if I had to make a prediction, I'd say no at this point. I've looked at past outbreaks. There was a big outbreak in 2008 in San Diego, California, that didn't seem to have any effect long-term on people's decisions to vaccinate or not. We also have short attention spans and a very short news cycle. And I think once this outbreak is wrapped up and moved on, we probably won't see a lasting impact.
What do you think are some effective ways to talk to parents about vaccines, about vaccine safety, to discuss some of the fears?
This is something that, you know, pediatricians and other primary care providers who see these parents really want to know about. And at this point, I would say there's not a really good evidence base for what exactly are the set of messages that will be persuasive to parents. I think we have a lot of effective messages, and we don't have good data about how to match those to specific fears or concerns that parents have. I will say, just in the past, say, week, you know, we've heard a lot of kind of backlash against the non-vaccinating, anti-vaccine parents. And I think that sort of shaming, blaming approach is certainly not going to work. That's going to make parents more defensive, less likely to listen to their healthcare provider, less likely to look at good, solid scientific evidence. So I know that's definitely not the approach that's going to work.
Allison, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Allison Buttenheim is an assistant professor in the School of Nursing at the University of Pennsylvania, and she studies vaccine attitudes. For most of us, measles are thankfully a theoretical topic, but later on we're going to hear from one family that has experienced the measles firsthand despite being vaccinated. Also coming up on The Pulse, when taking a quick nap is not refreshing but rather a symptom of an illness.
I wake up thinking, where am I? I have no idea what's going on. Oh my God. Oh, I'm at work. How long has it been?
A day in the life of a narcoleptic, still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. Independence believes in living like nothing can hold you down. But to live worry-free, you need someone to fall back on. That's why they offer doctors and hospitals across the region and a range of health plans designed to help fit your budget.
Independence is here to help. This year, you may be eligible for financial support. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. More information at IBX.com or 1-800-ASK-BLUE.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca promotes health and science education and disease awareness through initiatives such as the Young Health Program, which helps young people build personal qualities to live healthy, successful lives. Launched in the U.S. in partnership with the United Way of Delaware, the Young Health Program has reached nearly 12,000 young people since 2012. More about the Young Health Program can be found online at im40.org.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Think about how tired you are when you didn't sleep well the night before. Cranky, moody, perhaps. Now imagine you don't sleep well the next night, and the night after that, and the night after that. Things will get really bad, right? That's perhaps the closest most of us can get to understanding what it's like to live with narcolepsy. It's an illness that affects 1 in 3,000 Americans and often becomes a punchline, as if it were just a matter of dozing off occasionally. Los Angeles-based Pulse contributor Stephen Jackson spent a day with a young woman who has narcolepsy and is trying her best to live a normal life.
Julie Flygar was 22 years old when she was diagnosed with narcolepsy. It wasn't part of her plan.
For a while, I just got angry at myself. I used to drive home at night from law school and just scream at the top of my lungs in my car.
That was 8 years ago. Now she works in an office high-rise in downtown Los Angeles. She's on the 12th floor. She's got a great view of the sunset. It's a nice place to work. And most importantly, it's easy to take nap breaks.
Yesterday, I think it was 8 minutes. I went to my car and it feels like forever. I wake up thinking, where am I? I have no idea. What's going on? Oh my God. Oh, I'm at work. How long has it been? It doesn't feel like you're just napping. It feels more like my brain was really, really active.
Her sleep feels different because it is different. Most people go through several stages of sleep, each deeper than the last, before entering rapid eye movement, or REM sleep. In REM, your brain is active, your eyes move around, hence the name, and your body is paralyzed so you don't act out your dreams. Then it starts all over again. But people with narcolepsy skip the other restful stages and jump right into REM, which is why they feel tired during the day. Julie is driving home from work today, which I thought was dangerous if you have narcolepsy. But she says it's safe, as long as she listens to her body.
And I'll start rubbing my shoulders and stretching my neck, and then my head might just feel like a weight on top of it, almost like you're wearing some sort of a helmet that's a little too tight or something.
Dr. Tom Scammell, a neurologist at Harvard Medical School, says that feeling is impossible to ignore.
They can be struggling to stay awake in the same way that you and I would feel sleepy if we'd been awake all night the night before.
But feeling tired is only part of it. Like many people with narcolepsy, Julie also has cataplexy.
Cataplexy is this really unusual symptom. It's sudden episodes of muscle weakness that are triggered by strong emotions.
It's like a waking version of the same paralysis your body goes into during REM sleep. Usually it's brought on by positive stuff, like being surprised by a friend or laughing at a great joke. Sometimes it's mild.
But sometimes when it's severe, they may not be able to move for a minute or two. And they're awake and they're aware, but they're literally just paralyzed and they can't get up off the ground.
Back at the apartment, Julie's boyfriend Alex is home. I ask him what it's like dating someone with narcolepsy.
Didn't matter to me. Still doesn't. And you asked me that like on one of our first dates. She was really nervous.
I was afraid that he might not really understand, but as much as he could say, oh yeah, I get it, that he didn't really get it.
And I think my reaction even kind of threw you off a little bit, because I was like, yeah, cool, whatever.
Right.
And you're like, no, not whatever, like this is what it is. And I was like, no, I hear you, I get it, that's cool.
Right.
When they go out, it's not a big deal if they have to go home early because Julie's tired. But she'd rather avoid that, so she takes medication to stay awake.
I've tried all the different kinds of stimulants. Right now I'm on Adderall. Bag of pills.
She takes a pill every morning. On rough days, she takes two. The side effects are different for everyone, but Julie usually feels fine as long as she controls her dose. And at night, she switches from stimulants to a sedative called sodium oxybate, better known as GHB, the date rape drug.
It's pretty strong stuff. People can be scared of, I know I was scared of taking it when I was first diagnosed because I was afraid, like, am I going to wake up?
sodium oxybate regulates her sleep cycle and stops her from entering REM too soon. She takes a dose right before she falls asleep, and 3 hours later, she wakes up and takes more. For now, it's bedtime. It's late, and I'm standing in Julie's bathroom, pointing a big microphone at her mouth. It's a little funny.
I'm giving me a little catalepsy.
It's mild tonight. Her eyes flutter closed, and her chin drops to her chest. And then... it's over.
I woke up one night, in the middle of the night, to hear a burglar breaking in through the fire escape in the window in the living room, and I could hear it. And then I saw my door open, and this man rushed towards me with his arm stretched out to grab at my neck.
Sometimes, when Julie is on the edge of sleeping and wakefulness, her partly conscious brain falls into REM sleep, and she starts having vivid dreams that feel just like real life. If it happens while she's falling asleep, it's called a hypnagogic hallucination. And if it strikes as she's waking up, a hypnopompic hallucination. Because she's in REM sleep, she's locked in her body the whole time.
All I wanted to do was kick him away, push him away, run away, and I was absolutely terrified, but I couldn't move to respond.
And here's the weird part. All these symptoms, the sleepiness, the cataplexy, the hallucinations and paralysis, they can all be traced back to a single neurotransmitter called orexin. It's in the hypothalamus, and it helps regulate sleep. And narcoleptics don't have enough of it.
Normal individuals have about 76,000 of these cells. Narcoleptics have about 7,000 of these cells.
Jerry Siegel is a sleep researcher at UCLA. He says orexin is probably killed off by the immune system. But why is still a big question. Another question? How to replenish orexin and cure the disease? The answer might involve snorting the cells in a nasal spray or implanting them back in the brain. But progress is slow.
We're pedaling as fast as we can, but it's hard to predict when we'll arrive at our destination.
Saturday morning, after coffee and Adderall, Julie goes running in Griffith Park, a big patch of nature in Los Angeles.
The thing I love about running is that it's like... feels like it's a different, completely different body than the one that has cataplexy and narcolepsy. Feels so strong.
At the top of a big hill, she stops. She looks like any other runner in the park today. And she likes that. It reminds her that narcolepsy doesn't define her.
I don't think we're either like completely sick or healthy. People aren't just patients or caregivers or doctors. People are both, you know. I care for other people. People care for me. That's real life, I think.
For The Pulse, I'm Stephen Jackson.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. 24 of the country's 141 medical schools carry a donor's name rather than just the university's name, and the pace of these name changes seems to be quickening. Does it matter when Cornell Medical College changes its name to Weill Cornell Medical College? Dr. Danielle Ofri thinks so. She's an internist at Bellevue Hospital and recently wrote about this topic for the New York Times after reading some research on the name changes published in the journal Academic Medicine. She joins us now to discuss this trend. Danielle, thank you so much for being on The Pulse.
Thank you.
So what's your take on these name changes? Does it matter?
I think when it comes to schools, that it does, or at least it's something we should be thinking about rather than just going pell-mell forward into changing all these names. Schools have a certain legacy, a legacy of teaching, and medical schools are a bit in the public sphere in a way that other kinds of schools aren't. We often treat many underserved patients, and we're training the next generation of doctors.
And when somebody gets these naming rights, what does that cost typically?
Well, it varies. And the article, which inspired me to write my piece from Academic Medicine, did some research. And it big-ticket schools cost about $200 million to get a name change. Ivy Leagues, Cornell, UCLA. And then there's ones as inexpensive as $8 million in smaller colleges of medicine that get a name change.
Is that typically for life or for forever or how long?
That's a question. That's a question posed by these authors. Well, what does it mean and what happens if things change between the donor and their legacy? There's an example cited, the Bowman Gray School of Medicine at Wake Forest University had the name Bowman Gray for many, many years. And Bowman Gray was the president of Reynolds Tobacco Company. And at some point, it felt a little awkward for a school of medicine to have a tobacco name, which is the leading cause of preventable death. And they quietly changed their name back to Wake Forest School of Medicine.
Now, let's play devil's advocate for a second. What kind of good comes out of the money that perhaps, you know, is donated to the school for the naming rights?
Philanthropy is very important, and certainly if people are looking to donate money, medical causes, schools of medicine, hospitals are excellent ways to use this money. And large donations can potentially transform schools. They can change them from a small college to a larger research institution. They could open up new avenues of care. There's nothing, absolutely nothing wrong with donating money.
It's just the name.
Well, I wonder about that. I make an analogy for me. I work at Bellevue Hospital, which is the oldest public hospital in the country. And for 275 years, it's developed a reputation of a hospital who treats everyone. We've treated waves of immigrants, those with no other place to turn, as well as presidents and heads of state as well. And so there's a legacy with that name. And it's an earned legacy. Should someone donate $200 million, that would be a welcome donation to increase our services, especially to the underserved. But to change the name would seem unfair to the institution. The institution has earned that legacy. The donor hasn't earned it in the same way. They've contributed, but that's different than earning a legacy.
How do, in your experience, how do med students feel about this when their degree now has this big donor name on it rather than just the name of their medical college?
Well, anecdotally, many people have written to me since that article saying how uncomfortable it felt to have someone's, a rich person's name on their diploma instead of their university name. And they felt as though that they weren't angry at the donor. They respected the donor's choice to support their institution, but it felt awkward to have the name on the diploma. And I think it's particularly common in your fine city of Philadelphia, where many medical schools now have donors' names on them.
How do you feel about buildings? You know, anytime you go to a campus or a hospital, there are buildings that are named after a person. Here in Philadelphia, the Children's Hospital is about to establish the Raymond G. Perlman campus. So that's very common. How do you feel about that?
Buildings seem to bother me less than auditoriums because those feel more physical, whereas schools and certain institutions have a particular legacy. I take, for example, the Metropolitan Opera. That name has a legacy, and if it were changed to James Doe's opera company, that would feel somehow different.
So if schools get a name, who should they be named after, in your opinion?
Well, I was recently at Lincoln Center here in New York. Avery Fisher Hall, which was named for a donor, was looking to possibly rename itself, and maybe because the original family wasn't giving enough money. I don't quite know the background, but maybe a family with larger pockets. And someone wrote in and said, you know, instead of naming it for the donor, maybe a donor could donate the money to refurbish the hall and name it after someone like Leonard Bernstein, who embodied the Philharmonic. And I wondered about, wouldn't that be something interesting to name the institution? A donor who wants to support it could choose an esteemed physician, a patient, someone who made a real difference. And there's so many physicians who, in a particular institution, have really created that center of learning and teaching. Why not choose one of them?
So I guess your message to potential donors is do donate, but not your name.
Well, to think about what does that achieve? Are you contributing to the legacy? Are you potentially just having it reflect yourself? There's so many good ways to use money. I think names and legacies are precious, and we as donors should work to preserve them.
Danielle, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Danielle Ofri is an internist at Bellevue Hospital. Her latest book is What Doctors Feel.
Coming up on The Pulse, so much talk about the measles right now. What's it like when this illness actually strikes?
I felt so helpless. There's so little a parent can do once the child contracts something like that.
Still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse and believes that everyone should make the most of every moment. That's why they offer doctors and hospitals across the region and a range of health plans designed to help fit your budget. More at IBX.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Actively supporting nonprofit organizations to increase disease awareness, prevention, and access to medicines in the Philadelphia region, AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. Learn more by visiting AstraZeneca-US.com.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Wheelchair ramps, elevators, automatic doors, it's stuff we take for granted these days, but wasn't really a given at all before the Americans with Disabilities Act, a watershed piece of civil rights legislation.
I now lift my pen to sign this Americans with Disability Act and say, let the shameful wall of exclusion finally come tumbling down. God bless you all.
Passed in 1990, it requires businesses, schools, and governments to make reasonable accommodations for people with physical and intellectual challenges, and it prohibits discrimination. But 1990 was a long time ago, especially in computer years. As we come up on the 25th anniversary of the ADA, advocates say it's time for the internet to be included in the law. Todd Bookman reports.
It's either 1983 or 1984, and Austin Serafin begs his mom to take him to the electronics store. He wants to check out the new Apple IIe. And remember, computers are not exactly mainstream at this point.
And she said, they were so surprised. You know, they were so shocked. And I said, oh, yeah, they must have been shocked that a blind person, especially a blind kid, wanted to use a computer. And she said, no, they were shocked to have customers.
The 2E was a big deal in the history of computing, but it was a really big deal for 7-year-old Austin. It was one of the first machines that had a slot for a sound card, and that meant you could use special software to hear what was on the screen.
In this mode, I can pronounce most words in my English language.
It was fine. It was great for its day. It was totally fine because it was all text, you know?
Games, bulletin boards, early chat rooms, everything was just words and commands. A screen reader leveled the playing field. But then Windows came along, and the mouse became dominant. Soon, websites, images, video. There were now all these things on the screen that Austin was shut out of.
That's when we entered a dark age of accessibility, I think.
This wasn't the first time people with disabilities faced isolation from new technology. For the deaf and hard of hearing, television was difficult terrain until 1972, when WGBH, the public TV station in Boston, unveiled captioning during a cooking show.
This is soup à l'oignon gratiné. I'm just putting a lot of cheese on the top of it. And then a little bit of oil goes on.
Julia Child's The French Chef was a watershed moment in the history of media accessibility. On the web, gains for people with disabilities have been more subtle.
Link home, right up link, just list of 7 items. Link justice management division. Link
we're on the Department of Justice website under accessibility, under internet accessibility.
Angel Ayala is showing off how today's screen readers sound. We're inside the computer lab at Overbrook School for the Blind in Philadelphia. Angel's using the keyboard to tab through all the various links on this government webpage. He's so used to hearing the internet that he's got it turned up to warp speed.
Link sitemap, link archive, link accessibility, link FOIA, link know for your act.
Sitting to Angel's right is sophomore Marvin Pearson, also blind since birth. He's attempting to check his Gmail.
Where's login at? I don't know how this ain't working. Oh, there we go.
This is how it goes for these kids.
Oh my goodness.
For lots of people with disabilities, everything on the web is a little slower, a little more frustrating. But both still use it the way other high schoolers do. Marvin has Facebook and Twitter accounts. Angel is applying to colleges online. They say some sites work well and some just don't.
That's a huge problem with people who are who can't see the screen and have to deal with these graphics and PDFs and other things that aren't presented to us the same way it's presented to you.
To make a website accessible, it doesn't need to be all text or cluttered with captions or stripped of graphics. Most of the time, the changes are relatively minor fixes web developers make to the back-end code, where the screen reader picks up its instructions. Links need to be clearly labeled. Images need descriptions. Sighted people wouldn't see any difference. And when the coding is done right, it's the digital equivalent of a wheelchair ramp, the type of protection that the Americans with Disabilities Act helped make widespread. Advocates say the web now needs those same safeguards.
This is beyond just mere conveniences like shopping online.
Chris Danielson is Director of Public Relations for the National Federation of the Blind.
This deals with education and, you know, employment, being able to do so many things that I just don't think it's realistic to say in the 21st century that websites don't have to be ADA compliant.
On this point, the United States Department of Justice appears to be on Danielson's side. The DOJ is working on regulations to spell out exactly what an ADA compliant site is and to clarify which websites would have to meet those standards. These rules are scheduled to come out next month, though they've been delayed several times already.
We are hoping that they will contain a very robust interpretation of what needs to be covered, but there's just no way to know at this point, and it's very frustrating that the wait continues.
In the absence of laws, lawsuits have been the go-to strategy for disabilities rights groups. In 2006, Target was sued because while their brick-and-mortar stores were accessible, their website wasn't. In a settlement, the retailer agreed to overhaul its online service. There's also been complaints filed against Netflix, some big banks, and universities, including Penn State. But for a lot of sites, it was customers, not courts, that led to improvements.
Travis Ishikawa hits one in the right! The Giants win the pennant!
5 years ago, a group complained to Major League Baseball that much of their online content was difficult to use.
It was really a great grassroots initiative of baseball fans, particularly visually impaired baseball fans, who wanted that level of access, you know, to their games, particularly live games.
This is Matthew Gould with MLB Advanced Media. He says they just honestly didn't know the site wasn't working well for everyone. So when it was brought to their attention, coders made the improvements. At tech giant Yahoo, there's now an entire building on their Silicon Valley campus where people with disabilities play around on prototypes, identifying bugs before new products hit the market. Larry Goldberg is the company's director of accessible media.
All of the Silicon Valley companies really have people dedicated to the task. PayPal and Intuit and Google and Facebook and JP Morgan Chase, so many companies are putting really substantive efforts in, not just Yahoo.
And those efforts now extend into mobile technology. Smartphones, including the iPhone, come preloaded with screen readers. Austin Serafin, who still has his Apple IIe in a box somewhere, makes his living as a web accessibility consultant, helping companies craft technology that works seamlessly.
It's not just about helping the blind or whatever. It's about making a better website for everyone.
Because he says if a site or app is well designed from the ground up, people, no matter their ability, will be more likely to use it. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're in the midst of a big measles scare right now. Over 100 cases have been documented all over the country, most of them linked to Disneyland. But for most of us, talking about this scary childhood illness is thankfully a theoretical discussion. Not so for Rebecca and Sam Flint, whose daughter Sarah got this highly infectious illness as a little girl despite being vaccinated. They recount this trying time in their lives for our series, Patient Files.
It was April 1981. I was a graduate student at University of Chicago, and we were living in Hyde Park. And Sarah, you were sick, and you seemed to you had a bit of a fever, and you were lethargic. And I also noticed a couple of red spots, too, which didn't seem to make much of a difference. Anyway, you stayed sick for a while, so I had something to do, so Mom took you to the doctor.
Yeah, I took you to our local HMO, expecting not much, but the doctor took you in. And at that point, he came back and said to me that you had the measles. And was it okay for the rest of the pediatric staff, residents, to come and see you? Most of them had never seen measles before, and he thought this would be good for them to see it. The other thing is, I was really surprised. You had gotten an immunization at 12 months rather than 15 months. We were traveling to a family event in Rhode Island, and we were told that there were some measles outbreak there. So we thought, we talked to the doctor, and he said, well, it's better to get it now.
And the interesting thing, too, about the immunization is they used to give the immunization at 12 months instead of 15 months, and she was 12 months old. And you think about it, they were, in 1981, this is over 30 years ago, they had refined to a point where you got better protection at 15 months. They'd actually figured that out. I mean, it really speaks to the science and the accuracy of this. Anyway, you got sick, and fever, rash, slept all the time. It was not very good. And to add to the rest of the story, Mom had mono. Mom was sick as a dog. So you were in one room, Mom was in the other room, and I was in the middle saying, OMG, what is going on here? My family is a walking disaster area.
And I was a little nervous, too, because I had worked with young children as a social worker, and I had seen children who were deaf as a result of the measles, and that really scared me. And Sarah, and you were prone to having high fevers, and I know that's what sometimes brought on this deafness. So we really were monitoring it very closely, because I knew that this could be an outcome of the measles, and it really scared me.
Sarah, do you remember anything about that? You were, what, you were about 3 and a half. Do you have any memory traces of?
Not really. I think I remember a bunch of people in white coats smiling at me and wanting to ask me questions and look at me, and I think I liked that. I think I liked the attention, but I don't remember, you know, the symptoms or anything like that, which is a good thing, I guess.
The fever was high, and you didn't want to take your medicine for I felt so helpless. There's so little a parent can do once the child contracts something like that. So all we could do was try to control the fever. And I remember one time just with you and just saying you wouldn't take your medicine and you just weren't feeling it. And you've got to take it. And I forced you to take it. And you were mad at me and you were crying and all that. And I just closed the door and I went in the other room. And then it was my turn to just let it out. It was awful. It was bad.
Sam and Rebecca Flint and their daughter, Sarah Graydon, recalling the time when Sarah got measles as a little girl. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Avery Brookins is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Joel Patterson, our associate producer. Megan Pinto, the executive producer. Chris Atulo is vice president of news, and Christine Dempsey, our chief content officer. If you missed some of this show or any of our previous shows, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And we always like to hear from you. Email us with your feedback, your ideas, your suggestions at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.